This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work blends classroom learning with extensive field education guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. Israel and Hamas have agreed to a temporary ceasefire that is set to start on Sunday. But as of the time of this recording on Thursday afternoon, the Israeli cabinet had so far delayed a vote to ratify the deal after Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he was concerned that Hamas isn't keeping up its end of the bargain. Hamas leaders deny that claim. Meanwhile, the Israeli army continued to carry out deadly strikes in Gaza, with more than 80 Palestinians reportedly killed since the deal was first announced. If the plan is approved and holds, there would be no fighting in Gaza for 6 weeks. In the agreement, Israel has pledged to begin withdrawing troops. Hamas says it will return 33 hostages, and Israel says it will release around 1,000 Palestinians held in its prisons. People displaced from northern Gaza will be allowed to return to their homes, and 600 trucks carrying humanitarian aid would be able to enter Gaza each day. We got local reaction to this massive development from Rabbi Stephen Philp of Mishkan in Chicago and Rabbi Michael Schwab of North Suburban Synagogue Bethel in Highland Park, who you'll hear from later in this podcast. First, we'll hear from two Palestinian Americans from the Chicago area. Dair Ahmed is an emergency room doctor who's gone on aid trips to Gaza with the Chicago-based humanitarian group MedGlobal. And Diana Uthman is an educator and journalist with family there. Dr. Ahmed started by talking about what was going through his mind when he first heard the news.
Well, I mean, I think there was a tremendous amount of relief. I mean, for 15 months, the intense amount of suffering that was taking place in Gaza was tough to deal with, especially here in the Chicagoland area where you have the largest Palestinian diaspora in the country. Everybody's been suffering, watching what's been emerging. And I think for us, it was like, finally, please, maybe we can get started on the next step of this. Maybe people can start to process everything that they've lost and everything that was taken away from them. And I think that was kind of what we saw happening in Gaza as well. I mean, at home, I was watching the live stream of what was going on in Khan Yunis, as well as in Deir al-Balah, just watching people in the streets, just so thankful and relieved. So it was a very big deal yesterday when we heard this announcement.
Deanna, how were you processing the news when you heard?
I think my first reaction was I need to reach family and see if this is true and what they're hearing around them. And so when I started to see a few family members post online their reaction and sounds that were around them of people celebrating, it gave me a bit of relief. But at the same time, I also had a very strange kind of feeling that I shouldn't necessarily feel joy in that moment just because of the magnitude of loss and the guilt that I feel as an American here who's been living my life with all of the normal privileges the past 15 months while my family has had none and while my government has contributed to the deaths of so many of them. And so it's a very difficult situation to process emotionally because I am relieved, as Dr. Ahmed said, and I had that sort of, you know, sigh, like, okay, now we can hopefully begin to move forward. But at the same time, just the cost of it and the thought of so many people who are not going to be able to celebrate right now in Gaza, their first instinct is to go search for their missing or dead family members.
Right. But adding to that, Deanna, as I mentioned, there's more uncertainty now around the deal and whether it's going to go through. What do you think about that?
I mean, I think that was the fear in the back of everyone's mind and the hesitancy that everyone felt in really expressing that joy. It's just that you never know what's going to happen. But we obviously hope for and pray for the best and hope that this pressure from, other countries and the rest of the world will continue in order to make this ceasefire a reality, because this has gone on, 15 months too long. And we cannot let the people of Gaza down once they have seen this brief glimmer of a light at the end of a very long, dark tunnel. We hope that, this dream of ending this war will be realized for them, and that this is not just another ploy, that Israel has enacted and then will, rescind on.
Your thoughts around the uncertainty, Doctor?
Well, I mean, this is what Netanyahu does. I mean, and this is how we've come to know this figure who's terrorized Palestinians for the last couple of decades. I mean, this is what he does. He, especially if you saw in the last 24 hours, as you mentioned, the viciousness of Israeli attacks in Gaza intensified, knowing that there's a ceasefire coming. It's almost like they're getting their last licks in. And this is exactly what he does. He's a master manipulator. He tries to get away with anything that he can. He has a very extreme right-wing government that he needs to appease that wants to resettle the land in Gaza. And so this is the concern. And so I think he's testing the waters. He wants to see, is this incoming administration going to step up and put more pressure on me, or are they going to say this is not worth the headache? And, for me, what really, really concerns me and actually breaks my heart is, can you imagine if you have a loved one who was killed yesterday by the Israelis in Gaza, or last week, or the month before, knowing that there was like a ceasefire looming? I mean, that sort of unnecessary and just cruel sort of reality, that's what's playing out in Gaza right now. And so that's really what concerns me.
You mentioned your family, Deanna. Tell us more. Where are they exactly?
Well, they've been displaced from their homes in the north, and so they're scattered around Deir el-Balah, Rafah, and other areas, Khan Yunis, etc. And so they, have faced a lot, personal loss. We've lost family members as well. And one of the first things that I saw one of them post in anticipating this ceasefire is wondering if this will be the first night that they may go to sleep having eaten an actual meal. And so it's very simple things that I've seen them mention that just are absolutely heartrending. Not having, your child go to sleep with a full stomach for a year, not knowing if they will have a place that is dry and warm to put their head down at night.
So, what could a ceasefire mean for them day to day?
At least returning to their homes and assessing, whether it's they still exist or not, and that's not even known at the current moment. Figuring out how they will rebuild, how the children will resume their educations, how they'll adjust their lives moving forward, whether they'll have even, income, livelihood, all of these different things that, we take for granted in day-to-day life. This is something they're all going to have to start from square one with. And it's, heartbreaking thinking about the different stages in life that so many of them are at, whether it's, my mother-in-law, who's over 80 years old, who has had numerous medical problems that have not been treated. My husband lost his sister during this genocide, who suffered a stroke and went into a coma and did not receive the treatment she needed, and unfortunately, passed away in December.
I'm so
And
sorry.
so, thank you. So, I mean, this is very real for us. It's very raw. And, people just want to be able to just move forward and really understand what they need to do in order to continue to survive in conditions where most people, could not manage for an hour, let alone 15 months.
Doctor, in an address that he gave yesterday, President Biden pointed out that this deal is very similar to the one that was on the table back in May. How do you feel about the fact that it has taken this long for the two sides to actually come to a tentative agreement?
Well, I mean, I'm infuriated because I know what's happening on the ground. We're talking about a population that was intentionally starved. We're talking about the multiple hospitals that have been attacked, the healthcare workers, people that I know, my colleagues, have had to watch hospitals get attacked, get raided, and then be abducted, then their whereabouts unknown. So it's extremely frustrating. And what it tells me is that there was never that moment that the previous administration was willing to say enough is enough and to pick up the phone and say, that's it. And now when you see this incoming administration willing to sort of use that card, it's really, really frustrating. And what, again, there are so many thousands of people who have been killed because of that. You know, the president was told multiple times about the horrors that were happening on the ground, and he deliberately chose to ignore it. And his administration did the same. One thing specifically that I'll mention is that his ambassador to Israel, Jack Lew, this person is not a humanitarian. He has no background in public health. But when a report came out from the famine early warning system saying, hey, famine is returning to the north and people are having malnutrition and it's a public health emergency, instead, he sits there rather than say, hey, maybe it's time to pressure the Israelis to allow food to enter. He sits there and dismisses the report. This is a USAID funded report. He's sitting there trying to explain, oh, it's not actually a famine. People are not actually hungry. There's not that many people there. I mean, that's what we've come to know from this previous administration. It's diplomatic and political cover. It's excuses for why it's okay for thousands of Palestinian children to starve and for them to be killed, and that everything at the end of the day is justified. And that's really, really upsetting. I can't imagine what people in Gaza think about the United States, given what's taken place over the last 15 months.
Tell me more about what you're hearing from colleagues at the hospitals that you worked at.
They were so excited to be able to at least be able to restore operations and do their job appropriately. Everything that they were hoping for in terms of medical aid finally entering, insulin supplies getting in. I mean, you can just tell the people there were just ready for this to be over, and they were hoping to return to some sort of normalcy. But they all mentioned something very similarly. They said the entire population is traumatized, and they didn't think and they didn't know if they could be the same people again. They didn't know if their kids could adjust normally to what's taken place. And I think that they have a very important point here, that just because there is a ceasefire that's in place and aid will enter, I don't know that the population can recover and go back to how it was. I don't know that that's something that we can expect of them. One thing I will say is if the conditions of this ceasefire look like pre-October 7th in terms of the blockade that still existed in Gaza, we're in a lot of trouble, because the devastation and destruction inflicted on the territory by Israel, we're going to uncover once we get access, we're going to realize that it's magnitudes worse than what anybody was able to understand or grasp.
Deanna, if this 6-week ceasefire does come to pass, Hamas says it will release 33 hostages over that period. And Israel says it will release hundreds of Palestinian detainees from prisons. What are you hearing from your family maybe about that piece of the story?
You know, this is something that Palestinians have been dealing with as far as having men, women, and children imprisoned, some for decades, you know, way before October 7th. So this is a major part of the ceasefire deal that many people are on edge about, because they're waiting for loved ones that they haven't seen, in some cases, again, for decades, some since, you know, since October 7th, and others in the West Bank, you know, later into the genocide. So this is a very important step forward for these families who are looking to be reunited with their loved ones. And, you know, the rending of families has been such a huge part of this genocide, both in, you know, the West Bank through these detentions and in Gaza through the separation of families due to displacement. There have been families that have not been together since, you know, close to October 7th until today, because they are separated north and south. Mm-hmm. And so some were unable to evacuate with their family members for whatever reason. Some had to stay back due to inability to travel on foot for many of them due to illness, age, etc. And so that's also one of the things that people are waiting for, the hope that they'll see their parent again or their wife or their children. And so this is by no accident separating these families. This is something that has been very deliberate, and this has been a strategy that Israel has employed with the Palestinian people since its inception.
Doctor, one of your Med Global colleagues, Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, director of Kamal Adwan Hospital and Med Global's lead physician in Gaza, he was taken into Israeli custody back in December. What do we know right now about his situation?
I mean, I spoke to his son, Elias, 2 days ago. They told me the most recent update for him is that they think that he's been transferred from Sidi Tamim prison to Ofer prison, which is in the West Bank.
Do you think he could be released as part of this deal?
I mean, I hope so. I hope him. I hope my uncle, who's also in prison, I hope all of them get released in this deal. His family is optimistic, and they're hoping that among the 1,000 prisoners that are released, he can be among them. We're just very concerned about his state of health. We're concerned that he's being tortured because that's what happens in these dungeons. Again, it's kind of become normalized for healthcare workers in Gaza to be attacked, to be killed, and to be abducted. And so this is a very dangerous trend, and I hope that they can be released in this ceasefire deal.
Under the terms of the ceasefire, 600 aid trucks would be allowed to roll into Gaza on a daily basis. Now, as someone who has seen the destruction on the ground firsthand, talk about how important that aid is.
Yeah, I mean, it actually is close to the number pre-October 7th, about how many trucks were entering into Gaza. So I think it's somewhat, we need more than that. If you talk to the head of the Catholic Relief Services, one of the biggest NGOs operating in Gaza, they will tell you that they need probably 1,000 trucks. Mm. And, you know, I'm currently a board member of the Palestinian American Medical Association, and they're thinking that there needs to be a massive influx of not just humanitarian aid, but of commercial goods.
Yeah. Tell me, what's needed most right now?
I mean, for absolutely, without a shadow of a doubt, there needs to be food that floods the market. I mean, we're talking about people who are dealing with severe malnutrition. And malnutrition is a medical diagnosis that needs to be treated. And the other thing to really think about is these kids who are suffering from that sort of hunger, they suffer irreversible effects to their development. So we want to stop that in its tracks. We want to be able to get them food. We want to be able to get the water infrastructure back up and running. There needs to be clean water. Polio outbreak, scabies, all of these diseases are spread because there isn't clean water. So that should be priority number one, in addition to the very vital essential medicines, things like blood pressure medicine, insulin. We want to prevent the excess mortality, the unnecessary deaths. And to be able to do that, we have to make sure that we can get aid in without being obstructed. Mm.
Deanna, what are you hearing about what's needed on the ground?
I definitely echo what Dr. Ahmed said, food. That's the number one thing that I'm hearing from family members and friends, that they haven't seen meat, chicken, any sort of protein in months. They're surviving mostly on canned goods, portions of, one vegetable that they'll have to cut up between 20 family members who are staying together. The sanitation is definitely an issue. People not having access to bathrooms, or where they'll have to wait hours and hours to access a bathroom, which also is impacting spread of disease, both among the community and causing issues individually with people. Clean water as well. Another thing is tents. It's winter, and a lot of people have even lost the tents that they've had due to rain and other issues. And so they're just braving cold weather just out there in the elements with just basic jackets, not even a tent to sleep in. And so, you know, those things are needed as well in order for people to have shelter in the winter.
And again, I want to go back to the fact that some details of this ceasefire still need to be ironed out. And as we said today, it feels less certain than it did yesterday. It's also not immediately clear how we get beyond that initial 6-week period into something that's more lasting. How concerned are you that even the initial plan isn't a long-term deal, Doctor?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an excellent point, that there's this sort of temporary aspect to it. And if that's the case, you have to feel that that's also especially cruel. I mean, how can we allow aid to enter, pause things, and then resume sort of the killing machine and allow people to be in the line of fire? For me, that's a very important point here. And it'll be all for nothing if we cannot guarantee Palestinians in Gaza safety and security. And I think, at the end of the day, this is going to be on the United States. I mean, this is where we play a role here. I think it's on us to make sure that our government pushes through and holds people accountable. At the end of the day, I don't think Palestinians are asking for anybody to save them. They're not asking for anybody to sort of stand up for them. They're just asking for accountability. If we can have that sort of moral consistency and principled approach that we claim to espouse here in the United States, I think that that is all that's required. Just accountability for everybody. And I think, I hope that that's something that can happen. Of course, being a Palestinian and knowing our history, you know, I'm not optimistic, but, you know, I think that's where I turn to my colleagues in Gaza. I mean, they're the ones who are saying, hold out hope, do what you can, mm-hmm. and try to keep pushing the needle forward.
So my final question to you both, if phase one happens, what would you like to see in a phase two of a ceasefire or a phase three? What are your hopes for what can actually be accomplished in the future? You first, Doctor.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, it's about changing the status quo. The people in Gaza have suffered for far too long, long past these 15 months. Can we change the facts on the ground? And what I mean by that very specifically is the border that's between Egypt and Palestine, the Rafah border, can that be opened in a way that people can actually have that freedom of movement? If people want to develop and professionally grow, can they leave Gaza and come back? Can we make sure that stuff is getting in? Can we make sure that the medical evacuations can be let out? Everything that we've seen over the last 15, 16 years has said that people in Gaza are being punished simply because they were born there. And they're being punished by the Israelis and the Egyptians. And so I hope that the status quo changes. I hope that people are given a chance at life in Gaza. I hope that the kids who want to grow up and be engineers, that they can go and do that. And I hope that nobody stands in their way or threatens them. That's what I hope a second phase means. I hope it gives them a chance at life.
Deanna?
I mean, our ultimate goal is for the Palestinian people to live with freedom and dignity in their own land. And that means Palestinian liberation and the end to the siege and the occupation of Palestine. And so, you know, pre-October 7th, I was actually in Gaza a few months before. And returning to that condition is absolutely a failure on our part to advocate for our brothers and sisters in Gaza if that happens. Pre-October 7th, they were living with minimal electricity. I mean, every day they were dealing with electricity cuts, but they received only between 4 to maximum 8 hours of electricity a day. That's no way to live in the simplest of terms, regardless of all the other roadblocks and difficulties that have been imposed upon them due to the siege. And so they don't even have access to the rest of the Palestinian land. They are trapped in this territory and unable to move. And as Dr. Ahmed mentioned, you know, traveling through that border with Egypt prior to October 7th was an absolute nightmare. It was not something that was easy by any means. And so if we're simply returning to that, you know, that is a very, very grim outlook that we would have. And so as, you know, the optimism of the people in Gaza has shown us, we need to push forward and ensure that we don't just go back to what they were dealing with before, and that we push forward and that we continue this momentum and advocate for an end to the siege and an end to apartheid in Palestine.
Deanna Usman is a journalist with family in Gaza. And Tahir Ahmed is a local emergency room physician who's gone on aid trips to Gaza with Med Global. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
We'll turn now to Rabbi Stephen Philp of Mishkan and Rabbi Michael Schwab of North Suburban Synagogue Bethel. Here's Rabbi Philp on his reaction to the news of a potential ceasefire agreement.
When I first heard the news, I had a sense of cautious optimism, which is probably the qualifier I would use for most emotions that I've been feeling over this past year and a half, nearly at this point. But alongside the hope that I think is shared by many other people in my community and around the world is also the overwhelming sense of sadness of the losses that we continue to still hold in our hearts, and also anger that it's taken so long to reach this moment. And so sitting kind of in really a mix of emotions right now.
What's going through your mind, Rabbi Schwab?
When I heard about the ceasefire deal, my first experience was to feel a sense of relief and joy. I feel like this is a major break and a step in the right direction. And I really feel very similarly in the sense of I am so thrilled that some of these hostages will finally be able to come home after 15 months of being in captivity, that families may have an opportunity to bury their loved ones properly and to start some closure and having the grieving process. Even though that will bring with it a lot of heartache and sorrow and retouching the trauma, you know, that happened on October 7th. Mm-hmm. And I feel very, very relieved that this could lead to less bloodshed and loss of life in Gaza. At the same time, as Rabbi Philip pointed out, you know, there is a sense of caution here. The deal hasn't actually been executed yet. And we don't know what's going to be. And frankly, there are a lot of other hostages, whether alive or no longer alive, still in captivity. So this is just the beginning. And so I share that sense of accompanying frustration that it took this long and that we're not quite there yet. And I don't want to celebrate this as if this is the end.
Rabbi Schwab brings up a very good point, Rabbi Phil. But now that the Israeli cabinet has delayed the ratification vote, how does that feel?
I mean, I think this just speaks to the fragility of the moment and really something that we've been experiencing for these past couple months. I feel like every time that we hear any hopeful news out of Israel and Palestine, Gaza, the West Bank, one always has to hedge a bit and to wait to see if the hope that we're feeling actually manifests in reality, which is a difficult place to be in. It puts all of us in a place of deep uncertainty, which can be incredibly uncomfortable, and it can push people to try to search for simple answers to what is an incredibly complex and complicated situation with incredibly complex and complicated feelings that arise because of it.
Hmm. Rabbi Schwab, what are you hearing from your loved ones in Israel?
Most of my loved ones are also very cautiously optimistic about what is happening. I think that they also feel that this is a step in the right direction. Again, it rekindles a lot of emotions. You know, when you're hoping for this and then when it comes, it brings out a lot. The grief, it brings out the anger, it brings out the sadness, it brings out hopefully, the hope that things can turn around and get better in the future. I also just want to mention, you know, in regard to what I said before, that it's not just simply that Netanyahu and his cabinet might be delaying on this vote. It's also about the execution and, as Rabbi Philip said, the fragility of whatever this agreement was. This could be easily delayed, broken, by either side at any moment. And I feel confident that once the Israeli cabinet does vote, and I believe that they will, that Israel will execute its side appropriately. And then the fear will be that it breaks down in some other way at some other point. And so the fragility comes from both sides, not just the most recent splash in the news that Netanyahu is delaying the vote. I think ultimately the vote will succeed. And he just has some politics to work out. And I'm not a politician or an expert on political science, but I think this will be done, but it will be fragile. And let's hope that both sides can hold and all of the allies who are making this happen will be able to support it.
Well, you brought up Netanyahu there. Our previous guests actually had some critical words about Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on whether this was strategic to, you know, agree to a ceasefire, then say Hamas wasn't acting on good faith, but not having many details. So what are your thoughts on that perspective?
I think, to be honest with you, a lot of that is speculation. I'm not a representative of the Israeli government. I'm not in the cabinet meetings. And frankly, no one else who's speaking about it really is. It's hard to know what's going on. I do believe that when the Israeli government has agreed to things, they follow through and they stand by what they do. I do believe that the ceasefire will happen as written and it will be ratified by the government. So I don't think that this is some sort of kind of fake out in any way, shape, or form. every situation and every government has its own politics that it has to work out. And I believe Netanyahu sincerely and the Israeli government sincerely very much wants the ceasefire to happen and is behind this agreement. I don't think it would ever have been allowed to be announced by both sides and by both governments and so on and so forth if that's not ultimately going to be the case.
This deal is essentially the same deal that was on the table last spring. So, Rabbi Philp, what is it like for you knowing it could have been put in place much sooner?
It's frustrating. I won't pretend to know what is in the mind of politicians and policymakers. I'm not a politician. I'm not a policymaker. I'm certainly not a general in a military. But from the perspective of myself as a rabbi, as a spiritual leader, my job in this moment is to consistently reorient ourselves toward the world as it can be and not just the world as it is. And so part of that orientation is a reminder that our tradition, as shared with so many other spiritual and cultural traditions, abhors violence, mourns loss of life. And so from that perspective, this is already too late because we've lost so many people, Israeli, Palestinian, other innocent people. And I'd also dare say people who are fighting in this conflict as well, to recognize that in the Hamas militant, in the Israeli soldier is also human with a story and a family and an interconnected web of community. And so there's a deep anger and desire for justice that I feel, knowing that every month that has passed has led to more tragedy that from maybe a policy perspective was necessary, but from an ethical perspective is something that we can't tolerate.
How are you talking to your congregants about this?
Well, this is a feeling I think that's shared among many of my community members. And we as a community, as Rabbi Schwab noted, are deeply intertwined with the Israeli people, including having some members of our community who are Israeli, but we're also a community deeply intertwined with the Palestinian people. There are folks in our community who've been working side by side with Palestinians, looking toward a path for peace for many, many years, right? This is a conflict that precedes the moment of October 7th, the tragedy that's unfolded over this past year and a half. And so I think these feelings of frustration, of a desire for justice, of not wanting to accept the world as it is, as the world as it could be, are deeply shared. And so while there is a sense of hope and relief, as Rabbi Schwab pointed out, there's also this sense, this drive to remember that there is a deep need for work ahead of us and to remember that that work didn't start on October 7th but preceded this moment. There is, of course, a temptation for hopelessness and despair because the work that needs to be done is so great. But I also see a sense of resolve among members of my community to continue pushing for that future that could possibly exist, even if it seems really far away at this moment.
Rabbi Schwab, what have conversations at Bethel looked like?
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, they're similar. I think in terms of this idea that the same deal could have been taken a long time ago is very frustrating. And in my community, there's a lot of talk about how it seems that many individuals and entities in the world have very much minimized the plight of the hostages and haven't demanded properly that they be returned. And that is painfully clear now that 15 months later, we're still doing this and it hasn't even happened yet. And there are still many more hostages that have been taken captive. But I do think that the conversations are about whether this light here, a little bit of light that's come in, can lead to something greater and what that plan for the future might actually be. When I came on this program last, in an editorial I wrote, I said that this can't be a zero-sum game on both sides. People have to recognize the others as partners with legitimate aspirations and plan to be able to be neighbors and partners in the future. And that has to be the context for moving forward in any productive way that preserves the rights and security and ultimately peace and prosperity for both sets of peoples.
Yeah, to that end, I mean, Hamas, as a reminder, took 251 people hostage on October 7th, 2023, including a mother and daughter from the Chicago area. Israelis, they've been protesting daily for the release of the hostages, some saying, you know, the Israeli government has forgotten about them. Can you remind us, you know, Rabbi Schwab, about how your congregation has rallied around hostages?
Absolutely. Ever since it's happened, we've had multiple programs, memorials for those who we knew had died in captivity or were killed on that day. And we also have a yellow chair that sits on our bima, our kind of our stage for services, where the yellow chair represents the missing hostages. And each week we identify a different hostage and speak a little bit about who they are. And we have a group within our synagogue. It's partners with other groups in our community that do regular rallies around certain significant moments to raise awareness around the hostages. And we participate in all of the community rallies and all of the different advocacy vehicles in order to try to facilitate the return of the hostages. In some way, we hope that this is the beginning of some of those efforts. But we'd like to see it conclude with all of the hostages returning home, because whatever you feel about the politics or the geopolitics around these issues, taking people from their homes against their will and keeping them in captivity is immoral and unethical. And this should have been ended right from the beginning.
I'm curious, has the way that you honor the hostages changed over time? Because this has been going on for, as I said, 15 months.
Yeah, I think at the beginning, there was such an emotional reaction. It was a lot of solidarity, speaking about the big picture, about the 251 hostages, the 1,200, October 7th, you know, as an event, as an atrocity. And then over time, we needed to connect with the individuals themselves. And so we started making sure that people understood who these people are and what their lives were about and how they've been disrupted and who their families are and what these people stood for. Mm-hmm. We have an artist did a portrait rendering of each hostage that was taken in kind of a collage. And so that's hanging in our synagogue. You can look at it and see their faces. And every week we identify somebody else to speak about. And I think that's part of the differences. One was about the advocacy and the reaction and the solidarity about the atrocity of October 7th. And as this has dragged on for much longer than I think anybody has anticipated, we needed to reconnect with who each of these people are as individuals. Yeah. And of course, we're continuing the advocacy work, which is critical.
Rabbi Philp, anything to add there in that conversation just around congregants rallying around hostages?
Absolutely. So as a community, we've largely been taking our cues from the people who are on the ground, the people who are actually experiencing this firsthand. This includes amazing organizations like Standing Together, the Parent Circle Families Forum, which brings together Israelis and Palestinians around shared loss, and including hostage families themselves, which from the beginning have really been advocating for ceasefire with the return of the hostages so that they can begin to rebuild their lives or, God forbid, bury their dead and begin the mourning process. And so this is why very early last year I signed onto a ceasefire letter and why we as a community have been really trying to learn from and follow the lead of those organizations on the ground that are working toward peace, and not just a ceasefire, but also sustained peace that ensures the security and dignity of everybody who calls that land home so that something like this doesn't happen again, right? We recognize that this is not happening in a vacuum. This is happening in a historical context that long precedes this moment. And so really it's up to us to think about how we can disrupt that cycle so that there are no more hostages and there also are no more children being buried under rubble and there's no more soldiers going to war, that we can actually stop this cycle of violence. Then also the reality is that we're a community based in the city of Chicago, mm-hmm. and I'm a rabbi who serves a community in the city of Chicago, and so my primary responsibility is to care for our community, and a lot of that has included holding space not only for the complicated feelings around this moment, but also for the deep pain, the anger, and the possibility of hope as well that we're feeling right now. And to model, right, to model what it looks like to have conversations across lines of difference. If we can't do it here in Chicago, how can we expect it to happen over in Israel and Palestine as well?
What's it been like seeing the images coming out of Gaza this past year?
It's been absolutely heartbreaking. How could you not see yourself or your own loved ones in those images as well? there's nothing wrong with the particularity of pain that comes from feeling Jewish pain in this moment as a Jewish person. But our tradition tells us that we are supposed to make for ourselves a heart of many rooms, right? Not only a room for those close to us, but those who are not like us, or maybe those who seem like us but are distant, or maybe those who we actually might consider on the other side, so to speak. I refuse to believe that we don't have enough empathy to hold the pain and the loss of every single family and person who is grieving right now. And I think we're called to cultivate that muscle, particularly in this moment when it can be so easy to divide ourselves into sides.
Mm. Well, you signed on to a clergy letter almost a year ago, advocating for a ceasefire and for the return of the hostages. What led you to take that step?
Again, as I said earlier, right, I'm a rabbi, not a policymaker, not a politician, certainly not a general in the military. And what led me to take that step, again, is taking cues from people on the ground, right, people who are in Israel and Palestine, who are calling for a ceasefire at that moment, who are putting their own lives and well-being on the line to advocate for peace, and also to follow the ethical call of our tradition, to say that there must be another way forward. And possibly in this moment, maybe that other way is difficult or might seem impossible. But again, my job as a spiritual leader is to remind us that there has to be another way, that the world that we live in cannot be the world that we accept.
Did you get any pushback for taking that step?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's people who thought it was too soon or that it was maybe not my place to do that.
And how did you deal with it?
I sat down with them. I talked to them. I mean, if they're willing to have a conversation. But again, I can't ask other people to be in dialogue across difference if I'm not willing to do it myself. And honestly, when you sit down with somebody, and rather than starting in the place of policy or current events or what we think should happen, and start in the place of, well, what are you holding right now? What is your hope for this moment? What are you grieving? What are you angry about? We often find that we're not coming from such dissimilar places. We're often coming from a very similar place, and our concerns are often the same. And starting from that place, rather than the place of policy difference, can be incredibly healing and also remind us that the only way to achieve any sustainable change is to be in uncomfortable coalitions with people who don't always see eye to eye with us. And that's a huge loss we're experiencing, I think, here in Chicago and certainly in this country right now, is an inability to tolerate difference in our coalitions, to work together towards things that we actually all agree on.
Rabbi Schwab, do you think this ceasefire will hold?
I am an optimistic person. I believe in the positive nature of the human soul, and I really believe that it will. Anybody who makes prophecies or predictions is ultimately wrong.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's that helpful, to be honest, to make predictions. So what I can say, I think more constructively, is I really hope that the ceasefire holds. And I agree 100% that all of us need very much to be able to have compassion and caring for those who are not in our direct community, this idea of the heart of many rooms, and being able to dialogue when we do not agree with the person who's sitting across from us, and trying to understand that a lot of what the disagreement is about might be just a different reaction to the same set of circumstances. Somebody who's more concerned about security might have a fear, right, that is forces them or seems to draw them in a certain direction in terms of their policy. But the general analysis about what's happening might actually be very similar to another person who sees the same set of circumstances and is drawn to the hope and has a little bit more of a tolerance for risk and faith in other people.
Yeah.
So I really am optimistic about what's going to happen. And I think this is a crack in the door. All the concerns aside, and I do think the practical concerns are very, very real about how to dialogue, about who is in the room and what their attitudes are towards the future. But I really believe that this could be the beginning of something much, much better in the future.
Do you think the ceasefire will hold, Rabbi Philp? You knew that question was coming.
I'm also not going to pretend to be a prophet. And so I will say that regardless of what happens, to remember to continue to care for each other, right? To not let defeat close us off or dull our sense of empathy for each other, to continue engaging in dialogue with one another, and to remember that we have overcome every obstacle that has laid before us in this moment, right? We are here today. I'm thinking particularly in this time in which we celebrate and honor the legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., that we have overcome incredible obstacles before, that we actually have what it takes to get through this. And to remember that, I think particularly in moments, again, regardless of what news we hear in the coming days, to remember in moments that seem to demand despair, that actually is not an option for a better future, that we have to hold on to hope. And that hope, I think, comes from understanding the strength that we've always had within us.
We've been speaking with Rabbi Stephen Philp, who's Associate Rabbi of Mishkan in Chicago, and Rabbi Michael Schwab, who's Senior Rabbi of North Suburban Synagogue Bethel in Highland Park. Thank you both so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Linnea Dominic, edited by Dan Tucker, and mixed by Micah Yasin. Reset takes breaking national and international news and brings you the local impact and perspective. For more conversations like this, make sure you're subscribed to the Reset Podcast so that you never miss an episode. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We'll talk again tomorrow.
My name is Donald. I live on the southeast side of Chicago. I support WBZ because of the balanced reporting and covering so much about an issue as opposed to just the few seconds that you may hear on most other news outlets. It matters to me to hear the story more completely